Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we've got three tickets to Rock and Roll Paradise,
where you always rest in power. All right, this is a rather downbeat episode.
Yes, it
of
is, Jim.
Rockin' the Suburbs. We are going to talk about three musicians who have left us within the last week or so.
It's been rough, man.
I know. It just seems like almost every day we're getting news of another.
Yeah, this has got to stop.
Another passing. So this show is called Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we're going to pay tribute a bit to three artists of note, Daniel Johnston, Eddie Money, and Rick Ocasek.
Yes.
We're going to do them in that order. So Daniel died at age 58 on September 11th. And a much beloved musician, you know, not particularly well known, not a household name in any by any stretch, but much beloved by those who appreciate his work.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. I mean, I think Daniel Johnston is a fairly unique character in the history of rock and roll and music. I wouldn't necessarily call him a rock and roller in the sense of like Led Zeppelin or anybody right. like that. But he certainly expressed himself in a very idiosyncratic way, and he was certainly embraced by the indie rock community. He certainly found his home there, and I think felt at home there. He was a person who, like many people, tread on the edge of mental illness and mental disorder and creativity, and did that in a very interesting way. I think for Daniel, who basically found his footing when he was in Austin, Texas, as in his early 20s, he recorded a lot of stuff on cassette, and basically a lot of it was about the things he went through. I mean, his first cassette that he made was called Songs of Pain, and you know, basically was, here's what I'm struggling with and here's how I see the world. But I think in one sense it also helped him to get through what he had to get through and to deal with what he had to deal with in everyday life. I mean, you know, for anyone who's ever dealt with any kind of a ongoing chronic problem, be it mental, physical, or whatever, you know, you work hard at it every day to try to feel better, to try to find an equilibrium, and then you wake up the next morning and you're right back where you started from. You know, you have to deal with it again every day. And so it was really interesting that he took that approach. And I think, you know, art and madness have always been intertwined, you know, as long as there's been art and madness. It's interesting, Daniel, when he was, you know, a little bit younger man, his dad was an Air Force pilot and they were flying in an airplane at one point. And the story is that Daniel began to hallucinate and freak out and have a manic episode and took the keys out of the plane, and his father had to crash land the airplane. And it was after that that he was kind of really diagnosed and began to, you know, go into art and become this person who kind of stayed in his bedroom. So I have tremendous respect for the way he was able to deal with his pain and wear his heart and everything on his sleeve, and yet turn it into these melodies that were really compelling. If you've ever heard a Daniel Johnston song, you'll never forget his voice and the way he approached things. And once he started, you know, getting these cassettes out into the world, he actually got really embraced by the indie rock community in the late 80s and early 90s. Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth especially sort of had an affection for Daniel and supported his work quite a bit. And Kramer from Shimmy Disc and Bongwater and all those bands also supported him. There's a lot of people that really sheltered him and took him under his wing and gave him a lot of opportunities he may never have had. So it's great that he was around at a time when there was this really supportive community of indie rock, and where a lot of open-minded people really embraced what he was trying to accomplish. So I think if you don't know his work, there's plenty of it out there, and I would encourage you go back and listen to some of it. Homestead Records reissued a lot of his early cassettes. Shimmy Dist has an album called 1990 that's very representative that you can find out there. So I would start somewhere like that. And there's also a really interesting documentary about Daniel that came out in 2006 called The Devil and Daniel Johnston.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
He had a lot of famous fans.
Yes, he did.
I know that you and I once interviewed Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus. Mm-hmm. He covered Daniel Johnston on at least one occasion and had a certain, I think, kinship in some way with him.
Exactly.
Because I think Daniel Johnston was someone who achieved, I think, you know, you look at it, achieved, I think, a great deal. Now, he's not somebody who's had the same kind of commercial success as the other guys we're going to talk about in this episode.
Right.
But when you think about what this person did in a pioneering way, now we sort of take for granted sort of the lo-fi indie rock sound and the bedroom recordings and, you know, the DIY approach. But and here's a guy who didn't have the same kind of technology to work with as people have today, computers and whatnot, but was doing that in the 80s, right?
Yeah,
and
just exactly.
And crafting these really nice little songs, mm-hmm. and very touching, and wasn't doing it to get a number one record, was doing it because this was something that he felt and he needed to do.
Yep.
And that's why I think it's a great achievement, because in doing that, it found an audience, and it found an audience that that also felt that they needed it.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And so, you know, to me, that's sort of, that is, you know, true beauty in music, I think, you know, the story of an artist and how you can find an audience. The art finds a way, right?
Yeah, that's very, very well said, Jim. And I do think there was something about Daniel's music when you listen to it that appeals to a lot of people who are creative and artists and just people who are sensitive, because there's a lot of things that you don't necessarily ever admit to anyone else, but he often sang about those kind of things, those kind of feelings. And there's been some amazing artists that have covered his work. M. Ward did an amazing version of a song called To Go Home that's just very touching. And there's a lot of people who have taken on his work. So not only is that a big tribute to him, but his spirit and his braveness, I guess, in the face of what he had to deal with is pretty inspiring as well.
You know, Kurt Cobain was a fan and wore a Daniel Johnston t-shirt, and that sort of got Daniel Johnston some more attention.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm reading here, and I'm not even familiar with all these covers, but Pearl Jam, Flaming Lips, and Beck all covered Daniel Johnston.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
And once Tom Waits covered
Daniel
Johnston song. So if that happens, you know, and another, that's a pretty odd
another
couple.
Thing I find really touching is that Daniel Johnston once covered the Beach Boys God Only Knows on a like a Beach Boys tribute album or something like that. And you know, if you know the story of Brian Wilson, there has to be a real connection
a
there,
a lot of
too,
parallels
right?
there. Yeah, people that sort of withdrew into themselves and tried to deal with their demons through song and art and creation.
That's right,
absolutely.
So all right, so rest in power, Daniel Johnston.
Absolutely.
We did get an email. Mm-hmm. From a listener talking about Daniel.
Yeah, Kurt Gallagher. Mm-hmm.
Right, and he says, in the mid-80s, there was a fairly vibrant DIY cassette scene happening in State College, Pennsylvania, the home of Penn State University.
Yep.
I was part of that scene.
Oh, wow.
We would painstakingly design and fold our photocopied J cards after recording albums at home on whatever recording gear we could scrape together. Daniel Johnston became a hero for a few of us. I think that many artists get bogged down thinking about the quality of their ability, material, and performance. Mm-hmm. What I learned from Daniel is that the most important thing is to have a unique, identifiable voice.
Yep.
I don't mean singing voice. I mean the point of view and emotional landscape that you are mining as an artist.
Yep.
A lot of performers never get there. Daniel's cassettes had a look, sound, and vocabulary that was only Daniel and could not be confused with anyone else. And holy hell, could he ever communicate pain and isolation?
Yeah.
Just heartbreaking, deeply emotional, self-expression, and lots of it. It was a wake-up call for the artists who were lucky enough to dig into his work. I know I'm forever grateful. I've noticed that extreme drive to create in others. Over the years, I've met a few outsider artists working in visual media. Other musicians operating on a similar level of creativity that popped to mind quickly would be Bob Dylan, Robert Pollard, Mark Mothersbaugh, and Jason Molina, who I found out about through Scott Parks and this podcast. I'm sure there are others I'm missing. Anyway, thanks again, Daniel. Your gifts are highly appreciated, from Kurt Gallagher.
Well said, Kurt. That really says a lot right there. Yeah. Inspirational and brave. And if you don't know his work and you're listening right now, please take some time, take an afternoon, and really spend some time with what he did.
You can find it on the streaming.
Sure can.
Listen up and I'll tell a story about an artist growing old. Some would try for fame and glory, others aren't so bold. Everyone and friends and family saying, hey, get a job. Why do you only do that only? Why are you so odd? We don't really like what you do. We don't think anyone ever will. It's a problem that you have, and this problem's made you ill. Listen up and I'll tell a story about an artist growing old. Some would try for fame and glory, others aren't so bold.
Now, the next artist is on the complete opposite end of the rock and roll spectrum.
Very much
right?
So, yeah.
We're talking about Eddie Money.
Yep.
So Eddie Money died on September 13th. He was 70 years old.
Right.
And he had esophageal cancer.
Yes, he did.
I was always kind of a fan. You know, I know what he did was very commercial.
Yes.
And this was a guy who made no bones about it, had no apologies. He wanted to be a rock star.
Yep.
And he set out at a young age. He dropped out of the police academy, I guess, which was like the family business for the Mahoney family in New York. And he left and went to the other coast. He went to the Bay Area and he tried to find fame and fortune in being a rocker.
Yeah.
And it worked out for him. And so, you know, I think for anyone who grew up, especially, you know, like we did in the 70s and 80s, you know, he had a handful of hits that were on the radio a lot, on FM radio.
Absolutely.
You know, definitely heard Two Tickets to Paradise, but I also, you know, there was also Baby Hold On.
That was my jam.
Right?
Yep.
And the record I really liked came out in 82, was called No Control.
Mm-hmm.
I had that in my collection as a young kid because that was, they had a couple of MTV hits called Shaken, which I thought was really cool, and Think I'm in Love, which was a good little pop song. So,
yeah.
And Shaken had like a, I thought, a real kind of attitude to it.
Yeah,
I really dug that song. I think the thing I really liked about his work was, you know, it wasn't going to change the world, but he showed a real appreciation for artists who came before him or sound that came before him.
Absolutely,
and he really, he kind of dug that 60s R&B kind of sound.
Yep.
And he incorporated that into his work at a time when, you know, rock was kind of heavy at that point or, you know, kind of proggy and kind of, you know, that when people would talk about arena rock in sort of a derogative sense or whatever, you know, his songs had a little bit more kind of soul and a little lightness to it, right?
Yeah, I think that's well said. I mean, to me, Eddie Money always had that authenticity when you heard him, even if he was doing something that was pretty commercial and, you know, sort of, I don't know, mainstream, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
But he was like, you know, when Eddie Money came on the radio and you're driving around in your car, I never changed Eddie Money, man. I always listened to Two Tickets for Paradise or Baby Hold On to Me or any of those songs because he had that gritty sort of Mitch Ryder kind of soul. He understood soul, obviously, in Motown. And it never felt like he was trying to put you on like somebody else, you know. I know we recently talked about Robert Palmer, and Robert Palmer sort of in his career you know, we're talking about his early work versus what he did later, where he really went glossy and kind of commercial. But
right.
even if you listen to those Eddie Money tracks now, especially that first Eddie Money album, which is quite excellent, it doesn't sound contrived or dated or anything like that. It sounds like it's got a gritty earthiness to it. And sounds like Eddie Money was a guy that would hang out with you and tell you the truth, you know, and like, you know, let you buy him a couple drinks and tell you some funny stories.
You know, and then later he had a big hit where he worked with Ronnie Spector.
That's right. Right. Yeah, and that was awesome. And
Checked her in the song. Yeah. And it was kind of a song about her.
Just like Ronnie says, man. And those two voices together both had that kind of gritty, like, you know, I've seen a lot of life and kind of together. So
yeah, I think you're right. It seemed like, you know, like I said, even though he set out to become a rock star, it still seemed like this was the music he enjoyed.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly right.
This was the sound he wanted to do. And also, he seemed to have fun.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
know? Mm-hmm. Like you could tell he appreciated it.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And, you know, I think he always maintained that sort of sense of what he was and where he came from, because I don't know how many years back, wasn't that many, Jimmy did that Geico commercial where he was like singing Two Tickets to Paradise. Yeah. He was like a travel agent or something. And, and that was great.
He had a sense of humor about himself. Exactly. He appeared on the Drew Carey show.
Oh, did he?
Remember that?
No, I don't
Supposedly
think I did.
He was one of... he was like, if I'm remembering correctly, it was their character Mimi. He was like her ex-husband or something like that. Yeah. But it was like as Eddie Money, right?
That's
like,
really funny.
Playing himself. You know, I think he had a good sense of humor about himself.
Yeah.
I think he understood that, you know, he was not ever going to be considered, you know, a John Lennon or that kind of thing. But
exactly.
he didn't need to be.
No.
You know? He was living the life, right?
He had a hell of a ride.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got one phone call here.
Oh, sweet.
About Eddie Money. Let me play that right now.
Hey, Rockin' the Suburbs podcast. This is Pat Francis calling from Los Angeles. Wanted to just pay my Rockin' Power tribute to Mr. Eddie Money. A blue-collar rocker with rhythm and blues and soul in his voice. And he wrote those songs. I mean, I don't think he gets credit for that, but man, just an all-around great guy, and he will definitely be missed.
There you go. Thank you, Pat, for calling in.
Yeah, it was nice to hear from Pat from the Rock Solid podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really great. We know him back from the old show. It's great that he's still tuning in and following us. That's awesome. Thank you, Pat.
And he does raise a good point here. Because,
he really does.
Because you don't think of... Eddie Money was a singer. You don't think of him as, you know, a guitarist or anything else like that. So naturally, you just think, well, he just got up there and sang these songs. But he wrote these hit songs.
That's amazing.
He wrote Two Tickets to Paradise. Yep. He was co-writer on Baby Hold On. You know, he wrote this stuff. So
that's a great point, and something really important to consider. So that's really cool.
And we got a couple of emails here.
Yeah. Well, we got one from Phil Ingrassia, which
okay.
is nice.
What
talking
does that
about
one
Eddie
say?
Money. On Eddie Money's first record, he covered Smokey Robinson's You Really Got a Hold on Me, Phil writes. It was the first time I ever heard the song, so I'm thankful to Eddie for introducing Teeny Bopper Me to that classic. It also shows that his hit with Ronnie Spector wasn't just a random pairing. He really liked that early 60s sound. So that's really cool.
There you go.
And you know, I think we've talked about this on our show many times. You know, if it wasn't for X, I would have never found out about this other thing. And so that's really cool. I mean, if that's what it takes you to get into Motown or Smokey Robinson, the Miracles, that's even better. So awesome stuff.
Yeah, very cool.
Thank
All right.
Thank you, Philip.
Okay, so rest in power, Eddie Money.
Rest in power, Eddie Money.
Bye.
Just as we're recording this, this news just broke yesterday.
Goodness gracious.
Rick Ocasek or Ocasek. There, I've heard two different pronunciations on this. Yeah. So I'm not sure if I'm right or not. I always said Ocasek.
That's what I said.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So talk about, you know, really kind of a giant in music. I mean, the Cars were as big a band as anybody for a while there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a special place in my heart for Rick Ocasek, Jim. When I was in high school, I was real skinny and had sort of a mop of black hair that I desperately miss, and was really into music and kind of acquired the nickname Rick Ocasek. Like, people used to make fun of me. Hey, you look a little bit like Rick Ocasek. And I thought that was cool because as I got a little bit older, you know, I came to appreciate not only the fact that Rick Ocasek was the sort of producer and guiding light behind a band you might have heard of, the Cars, but also a very accomplished producer and musical genius in his own right. And that just continued to grow. When you actually look at some of the bands and artists that Rick Ocasek produced, it kind of blows your mind. It really does. And you know, I was listening before we were recording today, Jim, to a bunch of the Cars' top hits. And when you listen to that stuff, you say to yourself, okay, this stuff started coming out in, what, 1978? Something like that. The Cars' debut album came out. It was definitely late 70s.
Yeah, 1978.
Right. And so you say to yourself, like, is this a rock band? Well, yes and no. Is it a synth band? Yes and no. Are they a pop band? Well, yeah and no, you know, and then you continue to check all these boxes and you say, how in the world did they blend all this stuff so effectively? You know, it's not like their music was super accomplished. The guitar solos were great, but they weren't like Hendrix or Stevie Ray Vaughan. And
no,
and the arrangements were great and they had these awesome harmony vocals, but they weren't like Beach Boys five-part harmonies. And it's just amazing that that was something that they pulled off. It really is. And then you just start, you know, looking at the list of songs and you go, wow, I mean, stone cold classic after classic.
Well, that's exactly it. So yeah, I throw this term around a lot, maybe too much, but I think it definitely applies here, which is craftsmanship.
Yeah. Oh,
when,
yeah,
when you listen to a, you know, a Car song,
yep,
every single note is exactly where it should be.
Exactly.
Right. You know, there's a certain restraint, I think, in those songs,
yep,
that is admirable.
That's really
that they didn't that, mm-hmm, you know, there's a kind of a sparseness. You can hear all the pieces as they fit together.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It's not a wall of sound kind of thing,
no,
or any of that, where we're trying to, there's no like gloss or any of that kind of stuff.
Right,
it is like you can sort in your mind even sort of like dissect how that song was put together,
yeah,
and that even sort of makes it better because you're like,
it's amazing.
This is genius.
Exactly.
This is like perfect. It's
yeah,
like
yeah,
what could you possibly change?
Yeah, and what I'll say too is this, Jim. Think about a song like "Let's Go,"
mm-hmm,
and that really creative little wah wah ish guitar at the beginning. You know, that wow 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 wow.
Yeah,
and it was always touches like that. They were like, oh, it's pulling from this and it's pulling from that and it's pulling from here and it's pulling from there. Like, it's pretty amazing.
Talk real briefly. That, I mean, clearly one of the greatest debut albums.
Oh, of all time.
Ever. I mean, I'm looking at the track list here, and you know, side one has 3 out of 5 are radio hits.
Yeah,
and there's the other two you probably have heard,
of course,
know? And then and then side two has really all 4 of them, or you know, You're All I've Got Tonight, Bye Bye Love, Moving in Stereo, and All Mixed Up. Like, those are all songs, you know,
it's
right?
Pretty like, amazing.
Like, out of the 9 tracks, there may be one that if you played, people would be like, "Who is this?"
Yeah, I mean, exactly right.
Like,
yeah,
it's really quite amazing, and it's almost like you wonder, like, when they're getting advice from their manager or the producer or whatever, it's like, you have to think a lot of bands are like, sort of like, don't use up all your best material
right
on this first album.
Yeah, because
they're going to ask you to do a second one real quick. They used all this great material and then they came back with Candio, which
unbelievable.
Had more big hit songs on it, you know?
You know, and Bye Bye Love to me on the first album is like a sneaky, fantastically great song. I think the arrangement is so clever and the harmony vocals are so great. And I'll also say to Rick, wherever you are now, hopefully resting in power, thank you from a junior high kid for the cover of Candy-O for that second album, Mike. I greatly appreciate that. Yeah. I spent a lot of time with that.
So, we talked about FM radio of that era. This is the same era as Eddie Money, right?
Yep.
The Cars were played a lot on AOR.
Oh, they
radio,
really did.
And when you think of the sound that they were doing, which was kind of new wavy, but had just enough of like classic rock in it too.
Yeah, that's it.
That it crossed over in some way that just made it appealing to everyone. Because it had just like enough sort of guitar and punch to it that it would fit along, right next to like Led Zeppelin.
It's amazing.
Rush or whatever. And then you'd hear a Cars song and it was fine.
Right.
But yet most people think of them as sort of more of a new wave band. They definitely were pushing things forward.
Yeah, I think so too.
And when you think about it, so one of the things that surprised me in hearing about Rick Ocasek's death is I didn't realize how old he was.
Yes.
So 75. You think of that as guys who were musicians in the 60s, right?
That's pretty amazing.
And so for him to come in the late 70s, that means he was already in his mid-30s by this point.
That's right.
But here's what I think, thinking about this. I think this band was a classic example of the right band at the right time.
Yeah.
Like it would not have worked probably even like 5 years earlier, right?
No, you're exactly right. They had to be able to sort of come up in the clubs and still have radio to support them. And it was before, MTV, and it was before, a lot of stuff. Yet they adopted to MTV. I mean, about some of the Cars videos, and you're like, since you're gone, I remember that video,
They won the very first, video of the year, the Video Music Awards for You Might Think.
Yeah.
Well, there was a certain a visual artistic quality to, and I think a lot of that came from Rick Ocasek. You could just tell from the way he dressed this kind of Andy Warhol-esque of look. And then I think they worked with Andy Warhol
a
little bit.
At one point, yeah.
So you could tell he was the kind of guy who was always thinking about that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote virtually all their songs. I mean, there's some co-writing credits with Greg Hawks, the keyboardist. But other than that, it's Rick Ocasek. Now, interestingly, people associate him as being the lead singer, the front man of the band. And I think a lot of that is because of MTV, because by the time they were doing the videos, he was pretty much like the face of the band and did more of the lead vocals. But Ben Orr sang a lot of those early songs.
Exactly. If you look it up, folks, it's right there on the internet who sang a lot of the lead vocals. You'll be surprised at who had the lead vocals in a lot of those songs.
And he died several years ago.
He did. 2000, I believe.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me about that is Rick Ocasek wrote all the songs, but he would choose, this is a song that I should sing or is a song that Ben should sing?
Exactly.
Right?
And I think that speaks to his genius as a producer,
right?
And an arranger and a technician and craftsman. But look at some of the records he produced, Jim. It's kind of mind-blowing.
Yes.
Like, did you know how many Weezer albums he produced? Or did you know how many Guided by Voices albums, that he worked on? Or here's the one that always gets me, going back to the early days too. The not the first, but the second Suicide album he produced.
Yep.
Also Le Tigre, Kathleen Hanna's band.
How cool is that?
One of their records, which is pretty amazing. You just look at it. It's kind of incredible who he worked with.
Here's the big surprise to me, considering this would have been early 80s, Bad Brains.
There it is, Rock for Light.
You would not equate the Cars, that kind of pop sound and very clean sound,
that's right,
with a band like Bad Brains, but he obviously had interest and he saw what they could do and he was like, I'll produce you guys.
Yeah, Rick was an acolyte of very raw early proto-punk. I mean, the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed were kind of his guiding light, and he understood that sound from New York City and where it all came from and was able to conjure that up and understood it very well. I mean, Guided by Voices, think about the most home-produced indie rock band of all time. When they go to do the Collapse, they go with Rick Ocasek to actually make a record.
Well, and the thing is, you can hear it, too.
Oh, absolutely, which is cool.
Yeah, it does.
I mean,
it was like, it was
Pollard really, loved all that stuff.
It was really kind of a perfect matchup.
It is.
I think he's credited to a large extent with a lot of Weezer's success.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly right. But also a band that's kind of been, you know, a favorite of ours and kind of in a weird way on this show, Not a Surf, put yes. out, did a couple records with Rick Ocasek as well.
Well, that big song Popular that
there
we talked
go.
About.
Right.
You know.
He knew how to make it popular.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just mind-blowing, folks.
It really is kind of amazing. So.
Yet he was a pretty low-key guy, you know, personality-wise, and also a hero to many people who, you know, because he married Paulina Poroskova. So.
Yes.
Rest in power, Rick. Man.
There is that.
Amazing.
So, all right. We got a couple of emails here.
Yeah.
So Phil Ingrassio
mm-hmm.
said, the Cars album I still queue up from time to time is Panorama. The title track, Give Me Some Slack, Don't Tell Me No, and Getting Through are some of my favorites. It's a little edgier than other Cars records and worth revisiting if you haven't heard it in a while.
Man, I have not.
Yeah.
And I really need to go back and listen to that record because that's the one I always kind of considered. They didn't have so many super hits on this one. It was their third album after, you know, the
after
first
Candio,
two, Candio and the debut. And then they sort of bounced back after that with Shake It Up and Heartbeat City. But that's really interesting. I got to go back and listen to it, Phil. I haven't listened to it in ages, man. But I do have it. It's got the racing flag on
the
front.
Yes. Yep. And then Mackenzie Crenshaw
great to hear from
wrote
Mackenzie.
To us and said, I only recently started listening to the Cars. And Mackenzie is a college student, I think.
Yeah,
right?
I believe so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or getting close to graduating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I've only recently started listening to the Cars, and I only just realized how much I listened to them while working at a summer camp this past summer. When I would hike up a specific massive hill for some cell service on a night break, I'd always sing along to My Best Friend's Girl. I'd listen to a greatest hits playlist while walking our perimeter to check in on campsites in the pouring rain, sitting at the gate and giving a thumbs up to a dad playing Magic after he dropped his kid off.
Oh, wow.
The Cars made the hard or boring parts of my job seem a little less crappy, and I appreciate it so much more now. Rest in power, Rick Ocasek.
That's so nice.
Yeah. This is another thing, too. Have you ever met somebody who didn't like the Cars?
You know, that's a really good question, Jim. I don't know if I have, you know. And I'll tell you, since Mackenzie connected that really to a personal memory, which is really nice. I mean, I think that's part of it, too. You know, when you're able to connect those kind of songs to personal memories. I remember going to Meriwether Post Pavilion on the Heartbeat City tour to see the Cars with a bunch of friends. All of us went that summer to a whole bunch of shows. We bought one of those like packages you used to be able to get. And I can't remember who else was on that summer. I know Men at Work and a couple of, you know, it was 84. But I remember the argument in the car on the way back was, man, every song sounded exactly like the record. You know, they didn't do anything different. It sounded perfect. And then the more I was thinking about that today, what an incredible thing to be able to pull off that actually was. You know, back then, to be able to do that and to be able to have the discipline in front of a crowd that big, and we were sitting way back on the lawn, and it still sounded like note perfect to us back there, and they weren't mimicking or, you know, playing to a background tape. They were actually playing the songs.
Right.
And going back, it didn't sound exactly like the record. You know, probably sounded a little bit different, but that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if there's a knock on the Cars, one thing would be people were disappointed in their live performances because they weren't showmen. That wasn't what they were trying to do. They
were
craftsmen, right?
Exactly.
So when they went out on stage, and Rick was definitely the leader of that band.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
And when they went out on stage, it was like he wanted the songs to sound like they were on the record because he felt like those were the best version of the song, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the song's meant
to
sound.
We're not like the Allman Brothers or something like that and do like a
that's
jam.
Right.
That's
we,
not
we
how
don't
it works.
Do that.
Yeah.
No, exactly right.
And that's what I always liked about Elliot Easton's guitar solos, too, is they were so compact. It was
totally
like,
agree.
I have this many bars to tell my little story, and I'm going to do it.
And he
you
would
know?
Do it.
And it was just perfect.
I
you
think
know?
So, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very memorable.
Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome.
So, all right. Well, rest in power, Rick.
Rest in power, Rick Ocasek. Yeah, this is terrible. We can't continue to have this happen. But again, you know, 75 years old, that's a hell of a run. And man, did he leave a lot of incredible art behind. So, I mean, gosh, if any of us can say even 1/8 of that, that's
right.
You know, that's really amazing.
That's right. So you know, I think with all three of these people, it's true, but I definitely with him, it's music that's going to live on. It's going to stand the test
without
of time.
Without a doubt.
Absolutely.
Yeah, without a doubt. And thanks to everyone who chipped in and called and wrote us, and really appreciate that.
Appreciate that. Okay. I promise tomorrow will be a little more upbeat.
Yeah.
So if anybody does want to share more thoughts on any of these artists, you can email us rock@suburbspod.com.
Never too late.
Or you can call
612-440-1984.
Or find us on the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those @suburbspod, and we can definitely follow up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well. Never too late to get your thoughts in there.
Love to hear some stories.
Yeah, and your memories.
Okay, as I mentioned, we'll have something more upbeat to talk about tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow. I'll tell you one quick story. When I was in high school, mm-hmm. Heartbeat City was the big record of the time.
Yep.
And one of the guests we had on the podcast recently, Stephen J. Athanas from Toledo, who's in a band called the Wet Shavers that we hired to play at our homecoming dance. Well, I came up with the theme for the homecoming dance.
Did you? I didn't know that.
Which was Magic.
Nice.
Because that was the hot song at the time. And so we asked the Wet Shavers, would they play that? And they played it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
At the homecoming dance.
Great
and
slow dance.
And I asked Stephen about that. And he said, wow. He's like, I don't remember that, but if we did that, we must have really liked you guys because we didn't take requests much in that band.
That's awesome.